Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. A real challenge within a short period of time to say not everything that has to be said about in-law relationships, but even to talk to get at least below the surface. It is such a vast subject. I might tell you that there is a 200-page manuscript that I wrote on in-law relationships, and I'm in the process now of tearing it up and rewriting it because I've reread it and it's not good. I see many things that are mistakes and things that I have to correct. I think what I want to start out by saying that it's extremely important to be aware that the most awesome responsibility that a human being has is bringing a child into the world. When we bring children into the world, we have a choiv kodesh, an awesome responsibility of seeing that that child has the best opportunity to be productive and to achieve happiness. You can't give a child happiness, but you can make the circumstances such that a child has the tools to develop happiness, to develop self-esteem. If there is a difficulty in the home in Sholem Bayis that leaves a child scarred, children who have grown up in dysfunctional homes where there are problems between parents may carry emotional scars for the rest of their lives. Remember that. I had a patient, as you know, one of my areas of working was with alcoholics. And I had one woman who was a pediatrician, very competent person, but she was alcoholic. And after she recovered from her alcoholism, she became extremely depressed because she realized that her youngest child would go through life with the difficulties, both physically and emotionally and mentally, because she drank while she carried him. And she saw this as something she could not possibly undo, and she felt it was an unforgivable crime. And I think we have to realize that when young people get married, they are going to bring children into the world, that I don't think that there should be any other consideration on the part of anyone, husband, wife, in-laws, brothers-in-law, sisters-in-law, parents-in-law, grandparents-in-law, rabbi-in-law, whatever. No other consideration other than to see that the environment for that child should be healthy, should be harmonious with a true Sholem Bayis. That's not only the greatest gift that we give the child, but it is a chiyuv, it's a pikuach nefesh. Chas v'sholem, if a child grows up in a home where there is, for whatever reason, a lack of harmony, as I say, that child may be emotionally scarred for life. Keep that in mind. And so whether it is my position as a father or mother or a father-in-law or mother-in-law, and I have my needs and I have my desires and I see things that I would like to be otherwise, and I'm disappointed by some things, and all of that has to be set aside. There's only one question that comes that is worth considering, and that is, what is going to be best for the young child who's going to come out of this marriage? Now, I might tell you that in spite of what the jokes that go around about in-laws, that Baruch Hashem, I think that most in-law relationships, most mechatonim relationships are actually healthy. There are families where the families respect each other, the parents respect the children respect the parents. There's a real unity and a real harmony. And that's not the problem. That's the way things should be. And Baruch Hashem, there are many happy situations. But there are also situations in which there are problems. And I have been advocating that young men and young women should be much better prepared for marriage than they are now. I mean, we are dealing right now with an unprecedented divorce rate in the Frum community. And even in some situations where there is no divorce, there are some situations where the marriage is being held together by band-aids. And I think that much of this could be avoided if young men and young women were better prepared for marriage. You know, but the disciple goes and says something very profound. He says, what do you expect of a young man who for the last 8 years has not related to anything except to Shtenda? The Shtenda doesn't make any demands. You don't have to be considerate of the Shtenda. And now this young man is going to get into a relationship with another human being who has needs of her own. And the same thing is true of the young woman. And I think it is something which is sorely lacking. And Baruch Hashem, I now know that there are several programs that have started for giving young couples and even young men and young women before engagement some hadrocha, some concepts about marriage, so that they enter into it with realistic expectations and not with absurd fantasies. Because when the expectations are not realistic, problems are going to arise. At the risk of sounding commercial, I wrote a book called The First Year of Marriage. And I think it's a book that young people, even before marriage, or certainly when they're engaged, should read. The young men and young women should read about the kinds of things that can occur when two young people get together and try to fuse a new unit, and what some of the difficulties may be that they encounter and how to avoid them, and they can be avoided. I also want to mention one other thing that I think is quite important in our understanding and our trying to understand relationships. I was in my first year of training in psychiatry, and I was discussing a particular case about a patient with one of my peers. And he interrupted me in the middle and he said, Tversky, stop talking logic. And he was right. I was dealing with a situation where there was an emotional problem and I was trying to apply logic to it. Emotional problems don't necessarily follow logic. There is a great deal of feelings, a great deal of ideation that has nothing to do with logic. And I think that psychology has made some very significant discoveries in how this can happen. For example, there is a kind of psychological mechanism called displacement. Displacement means that I have some sort of feelings toward you. All right? But I can't express those feelings toward you. I may not even want to think that I have those feelings toward you, because they're not proper. So my mind does a very keen trick. It displaces those feelings toward somebody else. Right? Because to that other person, it's all right to feel that way. Now that means that a young man or a young woman who may have had difficulties in relating to a father and mother and may have had resentments toward the father and mother and feels very terrible about that. In fact, may not even realize that that's what they're feeling. And what happens is that when they get into another situation where they now have a different father and mother, right, a father-in-law and a mother-in-law, that they project the feelings toward the father-in-law and mother-in-law that they had toward the father and the mother. Are you with me on that? Yeah. And if they have any difficulty with the mother-in-law, it may not be anything that their mother-in-law has done. But it's a projection of the feeling that came from one place to another. In general, there is a category of psychological mechanisms called transference, which means that I transfer the feeling from one object, from one person to another. And it doesn't have to be logical. Now, the mind has some very strange ways of working. And if you want to know how strange the mind can work, think of some of the crazy things that we see in dreams. Right? Things that are totally illogical. There's a lot of that mechanism goes on in the normal mind. So, a wheel is a wheel, yes? A wheel is not a car. Logically, a wheel is one part of a car. To the unconscious mind sitting in the back of it, a wheel is a car. Right? You say, but a wheel is not a car. I said, yeah, that's logic. Right? But to the unconscious mind, a wheel is not is a car. What happens then is something like this. I had a fifth grade teacher, which happens to be true, who everybody was afraid of Chas v'Shalom getting into her class. Because she had a reputation of being extremely strict, extremely harsh toward the children. And what can I tell you? All the kids hated her. Right. Now, think of it this way. This young man had this teacher whom he despised. Okay. 15 years later, he meets someone who in a very remote way somehow reminds him of that teacher. Right? She wears her hair the same way, that's all. That's enough. They're identical. Right? He can already relate to this new person, right, with all of the feelings that he had 15 years ago toward the other person. Now that's not logical, but it happens. Tell me, haven't you ever come into a situation when you walk into a room and you meet someone and all of a sudden you don't like them? Right? You never saw that person before. You never exchanged three words with them. You don't like them. And on the other hand, sometimes you meet a person and immediately you have a strong affection for him. That can be positive and negative, right? I remember a young woman was referred to me. She had gone to three different psychiatrists. And she was referred to me because they thought that I had a method that would be able to help her. So a young Jewish woman. And she came in after telling me her problem, she said to me, "Do you know something? My Zaidi, he was such a wonderful man. He used to give me candy, used to play me, used to take me to the park. He had a long white beard. You remind me of my Zaidi." I knew I was going to have a cure. Right? That was a foregone conclusion, right? I was her Zaidi, right? No, I wasn't her Zaidi, right? But the way she looked at it. So I think we have to realize this phenomenon, that when you have feelings towards someone, now positive feelings I'm not worried about, but if you have negative feelings towards someone, catch yourself. Sometimes they may be justified, but it can also happen that you develop a negative feeling for no logical reason at all because of displacement and transference. Right? Tremendously important. Because if we don't realize that, if I find myself that I don't like him, or I don't like her, you know, I mean, my logic has to come up with a reason. Why don't I like him? Why don't I like him? So I find a reason. You know, it's not hard to find reasons why you don't like somebody. Right? And you find chesronos, you find problems. And if we would only understand that the feelings that we have may be based on some early experiences and are in no way justified, then maybe we wouldn't allow them to progress and escalate to become significant problems. And I think that's one of the problems with in-law relationships. And it can work both ways, of children toward parents-in-law or parents-in-law toward children-in-law. I think we also have to realize that we naturally have strong attachments toward our children. Of course. And parents cry at the chuppah, right? Yes, so why are they crying? Because they're happy. When you're happy, you don't cry. And the answer is, yes, they are happy, but they also realize that there's going to be a change in relationship. You know, this young man or this young woman, who for the last 20 or 21 years or whatever, right, has been so close, and now is going to be separated. Now, that's a kind of loss. It's a healthy loss. But it's a loss, and it can hurt. And I think that it's important that young men and young women realize that their parents are thrilled that they're getting married and that they have acquired a new son and a new daughter, but they also have to realize that the parents may feel the pain of a loss and to do whatever they can to try and minimize that. And it can be done. Can be done. Sometimes, for whatever reason, a young man or a young woman may have, because of previous experiences, felt that closeness resulted in their loss of identity because they may have had a father or mother who tried to control them too much. And they were looking forward toward the day when they're going to get away from that. And then they get married and they may see something in the in-laws that make them think that, hey, I think this is a repetition, right? More control. And again, we have to realize that the fact that parents still want to maintain a close relationship with children after they're married does not mean that they want to control them. There's another problem that is that can cause difficulties, and that is the struggle that we each have with dependence and independence. We all, from a very early stage in life, strive for independence. If you've noticed, your two-year-old kids want to be independent. Right? I remember when my oldest child was, what was he, two-year-old, whatever age it was, if we put on his jacket, trying to help him on with his jacket, he would grab the jacket and turn away and say, myself. Right? Little children have a need to feel big. Right? And they want to be independent. But the problem is, they are terribly frightened of being independent. Right. So they want the dependency on their parents, and they want their parents to care for them, and these two feelings clash. Right. And that can begin at a very early stage in life and go right through adulthood. The dependence-independence conflict. Sometimes it comes in very absurd fashions. I had a colleague who is a very famous surgeon, and he suffered a heart attack, and he was in the intensive care unit. And on the third day in intensive care, he disconnected all the intravenouses and all the monitors and walked out. He could not tolerate somebody caring for him. He had to be totally independent if it meant that it would kill him. So, on the one hand, we may want independence, and on the other hand, we're frightened of it. And one of the times when the dependence-independence struggle comes to a high pitch is when young people get married. And now they want to be independent. And they may resent any kind of dependency. And yet there may be, it may be very necessary realistically for them to be dependent. They may need financial support. And so they've got this conflict of dependence and independence. Now, if these things could be talked out, if young people and if in-laws could have an opportunity to ventilate what's going on, these things could be clarified, and they don't have to become problems. But when we keep it all in, and we try to find solutions in our own ways, and we try to react to situations, sometimes we react, and we may react in such a fashion that will bring forth another reaction, and you get a vicious cycle going. Things can arise in in-law relationships with things that are so superficial. What do you call your in-laws? Do you call your father-in-law dad? Do you call your mother-in-law mom? Some people don't feel comfortable at doing that. For some reason or other, in Yiddish, there's a different problem because we've given connotations to terms, right? The word shviga, for some reason or other, connotes a bad person. No. Not so. Not so. My shviga was a wonderful, wonderful person. But somehow or other, the word shviga, it's not as bad. I don't know why shviga was not as bad, but shviga was bad. And so it's a question, as some mothers-in-law have said, please don't call me mom, I'm not your mother. And another woman has said, just call me mom. And probably the best solution is for the young people to ask their in-laws, what would you like me to call you? How shall I address you? You know, in the secular world, you call them by their first name, which, of course, we would never allow that. But these are tiny little things, but they can cause problems. I think that it's important to realize that how mechatonim relate to each other can also have an effect on the children. And for heaven's sake, the chuppah is not a time at which to stand on one's own traditions. And I've seen situations where at the chuppah some difficulty broke out because in the chosson's family the tradition, the custom was that both parents take the chosson to the chuppah, both the father and mother. In the other family, no. The two fathers conduct the chosson, the two mothers conduct the kallah. This one wants it his way, this one wants it his way. And Rav Pamas Chanavocha said, Rabbeinu Shalaylam, you're going to take and start off children's life, right, with a kind of machlekes, with a kind of descent of how far somebody's going to walk 10 meters. Right? Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky Zechon Levocha said, my minig is to do whatever the mechatonim want. You don't have to stand on your own kind of thing. My way is the only right way. But at a time when children should be joined together in the ultimate happiness, to feel that there's any kind of dissension, and who's going to get the kibbutz and who's going to get this kibbutz, I mean, all of these kinds of things are such trifles And when we keep in mind what we're talking about, and I started off with saying the awesome responsibility of starting off and keeping a true Shalom Bayis and not letting anything interfere with it. Certainly, kinds of things, petty squabbles over things that have no meaning at all. Now, I'm not saying tradition hasn't any meaning. Certainly traditions are important. But the question is, what price do you put on tradition? If I have my tradition, you have yours, we ought to respect each other. Say, do it your way, do it my way. There's no halacha on that. I think we have to realize that when a young woman comes into a new family, a young man comes into a new family, that we can't expect relationships to be totally ideal from the beginning. It takes time to develop relationships. It's very interesting that the Gemara says that the relationship of a husband to a wife should be that he loves her as much as he loves himself. And he respects her even more than he respects himself. That's the language of the Gemara. When the Rambam comes to the Halacha, he says the same thing, but he just turns the thing around, saying first, he should respect her more than he respects himself, and then, he says, and he should love her more as much as he loves himself. Now, why did the Rambam change around the order of the Gemara? Because the Rambam understood that love is not a thing that's going to start from day one in perfection. It's going to take time to develop. You cannot tell a person at the beginning of a relationship to another person, you must love her as much as you love yourself. Hey, give me a break, it's going to take time. I don't even know the person yet. Right? Respect can start from day one. Right? So I think that in in-law relationships, that respect should start from day one. The kind of affection that you feel, that's going to take time to develop. And that goes both ways, both with the in-laws, the parents-in-law, and the children-in-law. In many of our families, it happens to be the reality that the young people are going to have to be supported financially for a number of years. And parents do so and should do so for only one reason, because they love their children and they want to give their children the best opportunity to be able to develop a life for themselves. Supporting a child does not mean that you have a right to call the shots. Right? And unfortunately, it may happen that someone says, I'm paying for it, it's going to be done my way. I'm going to be paying your rent, you're going to live where I want you to live. That's a terrible distortion of the power of money. You want to support the child, you should, because it's the right thing to do. Right? And the children should acknowledge it and respect it and be grateful for it. But no control. I think it's important that young people, and I'm glad that there are many young people here, I think that young people should realize that even at the age of 20, we don't know everything in the world yet. And there are things that people who have gone through life and who have had experience may know better than we do. And I think that young people should ask the advice of their parents and of their in-laws. Ultimately, they have to make their own decision. And it would be important that if their decision is going to be different than what their parents recommend, that what they would be wise to do is to find a competent person, a love who has had experience with marriage situations, to talk it over with him, or a Rebbetzin who has had the experience, or perhaps a marriage counselor, and not rely on one's own judgment, realizing people who have been around longer may have had some correct ideas. Right? You know, when it comes to buying furniture, the fact that the parents-in-law or the parents are footing the bill does not mean that they have a right to choose the furniture. Right? They may like period, they may like modern. The children are going to live with that furniture, they should have the right to choose what they like. But that doesn't mean that the children should not ask their opinion, because there may be some things that the parents, having had the experience, know which is a good buy and which is not a good buy. And all of these things, if they're approached objectively and without the emotional kind of thing, I don't want you to control me, I don't want you to tell me, I think those things can be worked out. An important thing for everybody to know, young people and parents, marriage does not change a person. Too often I've heard it say, we'll get married, she'll make a mensch out of him. That's not right. That's not fair. Marriage is not a hospital. People who have problems, if they don't resolve the problems before they get married, the problems are apt to get worse, not better. And today we live in an age where the stresses are unprecedented, and I'm sure that there are many young people who have problems that two generations ago did not exist because of the kind of environment that we're living in. I think that this is the prime reason why it's so important to get proper preparation for marriage and not assume, well, my father and mother, my grandfather, my grandmother, they didn't have to have courses about marriage. Right? It was a different world. Today's world is totally different, and our children have to grow up and live in today's world. There are four buzzwords that I would like everyone to know, parents-in-law and children-in-law. One is empathy, E-M-P-A-T-H-Y, empathy. Now, what does empathy mean? Empathy is not sympathy. Empathy does not mean feeling sorry for somebody. Empathy means what my mother used to refer to, the holy altoden. Pilkiova says, don't judge another person until you've been in his position. Right? My mother used to refer to that as the holy altodin, that the greatest principle in life. Right? To be able to realize this person may have a view of something which I don't understand. And I have to try and understand. I don't have to agree with it. But I have to try to understand where she or he is coming from. Right. And this is true of children toward the parents and in-laws and parents-in-law to children. Empathy, to be able to understand where this comes from. Let me give a very simple example. Young woman grew up in a situation where her mother died when she was 3 years old. The father remarried. The relationship of the stepmother to the stepdaughter was not a good one. Okay. Two things can happen. Either when she gets married, she may carry the resentment that she had toward her stepmother, toward her mother-in-law, or she now has been so longing for her mother, right, that she wants the mother-in-law to be her mother. Now, a mother-in-law can be an excellent mother-in-law, but can't become a mother. And it may be making an unrealistic demand. She has such a need, such a tremendous need, and it may be an unrealistic need. So that's just an example of if we could understand where this young woman is coming from, why she may have feelings like this, either positive or negative feelings. empathy, trying to understand what their person is coming from. Each of us can have different perspectives. You know, I did a lot of work with the wisdom of the cartoonist Charles Schulz, and who wrote the Snoopy comic strip, and I've written books about his wisdom. Anyway, he has one cartoon which is so wonderful. He has a cartoon where a little girl is standing looking out the window, and it's a bright sunny day, and right next to her there's a little boy standing, and he's looking at the blackboard, and he says, "Wow, is it ever dark outside today?" Yeah, it's not dark outside. But if you think that the blackboard is a window, it looks awfully dark. And sometimes we have distortions that give us a mistaken perception in life. And if we don't have anyone who can help us identify these distortions, we can go ahead and build on that. And we can act as though the world is a very dark place, even when it's bright and sunny. So, empathy. To try to understand where another person is coming from. My mother's statement, the Heiliker Altodin. The second buzzword is consideration. To be considerate of another person's feelings. Yes, I want other people to be considerate of my feelings as well. But that's their problem. I have to be considerate of another person's feeling. And this goes, of course, with everybody. This goes certainly with husband and wife and parents and children and in-laws. And but to be considerate of another person's feelings. An enormous sensitivity, right, to avoid offending someone. I was just mentioning to the young man who drove us, young people who drove me here today, the sensitivity that our great people showed, that our Gedolim showed, Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Zechonu Livracha, was until his very last years, he refused to take a taxi to the yeshiva. Because he says, on public funds, he has no right to squander money on yeshiva, he can go by bus. So he was going by bus to the yeshiva in Yerushalayim. And a young woman came on the bus, and I guess it was a warm day, and she was dressed rather scantily. And she came and sat down next to the Rosh Yeshiva. The Shlomo Zalman waited a moment, and he pushed the button for the bus to stop at the next stop. And he said, "Slicha, ani tzarich leredet. Excuse me, I have to get off." So he got off, and he waited and took the next bus. So someone who saw what happened there said to him, "Why did you have to do that? Why didn't you simply get up and move to another seat?" Reb Shlomo Zalman says, "Because she does not dress with tznius, I have a right to humiliate her." Right? Do you realize the sensitivity of that? Right? He had every right in the world to get up and go to another seat. It was improper for him to be sitting next to her. But he realized that might hurt her feelings. If we have that kind of sensitivity of consideration for another person's feelings, and we went out of our way to see that the other person doesn't get hurt, do you know what that would do to relationships between everybody? Let alone in close family situations. In-laws, parents-in-law, husband, wife. The third buzzword is patience. Patience, patience, have geduld. This is something which is sorely missing today because technology is taken away from us. As a result of technology, we now have things that are instantaneous, and we expect everything else to be instantaneous. When I grew up, I knew what it meant to wait. Right? I remember traveling from Milwaukee to Los Angeles in the Transcontinental Railroad, and it took 2 days and three nights to get there. That was okay. Now when I fly and it takes 5 hours, At the end of the third hour, I'm impatient. And you know what you feel like when you travel 10 or so. You know, it's a 10-hour drive, 10-hour flight. And you know what you feel like at the end of 6 hours, 7 hours. No, when's it going to be already? When's it going to be? It used to take 6 weeks. But that's what technology has done. And if you go back into your homes and open up your pantries, look how many instant foods you have. And what's not in the pantry is in the freezer. And then we have a microwave. And we have fax machines. And we have email. Right? I used to be struck by the fact that they're advertising automobiles, and this particular automobile costs $40,000 more than the other. But the yichus is, it goes from 0 to 60 miles an hour in 6.7 seconds. So what good is that? My car takes 12 seconds. So for those 4 point something seconds, I should spend in a different $40,000. And today I happen to notice an automotive magazine, 4.7 seconds. And we're into a kind of thing where we have, it's done something to us. It's taken away from our ability to delay. Things have to happen quickly. Now, relationships take time. And with empathy and with consideration, patience is necessary. Things are going to take time to develop. They're not going to happen overnight. I remember a case where a woman said to her new daughter-in-law, "Don't think that just because you're marrying my son, you're coming to this family, you're going to be a member of this family right away." Now, maybe that wasn't the wisest thing to say. Right? But the fact is that it is a true fact. You know? It's going to take time to become a member of a family. And it's a unrealistic expectation to think that's going to happen instantaneously. Now, I don't approve of what she said because of it's also possible that sometimes an in-law may say things that are unwise. Like a mother-in-law who came into her newlywed children's home. And she walked in. And the young woman said, "Oh, ma'am, I didn't know you were coming." She said, "You didn't have to know I was coming. This is my son's house. I can walk into whatever I want." Now, you have to respect privacy. On the other hand, there was an incident in which a young woman was terribly upset because she prepared some of the food and it didn't turn out good. It burnt or whatever. And she was crying, and the mother-in-law came in and she said, "You're crying over that? Let me tell you what happened to me once." Right? And she told her some kind of story, whether it was true or not, about having had a disaster with the leaving of the turkey, and until it became a cold moila, you know, it became... and of course, you know, she comforted the child because she was able to relate to her something that had happened to her. And, you know, like it's okay. The fourth thing is tolerance, which is somewhat similar to patience. But tolerance means being able to tolerate things without reacting. Give yourself time to think it over. Don't react immediately. Something may seem to you as to be very, very tough. Build tolerance. And we can understand that that person may have a totally distorted concept of what happened, and based on their concept, that's why they're reacting. Remember a case of a woman who had an opportunity. She went to a store that there was a fantastic sale. You know, one of these things they had bought off stores that had gone out of business. And she bought 3 dresses for her daughter-in-law at a very cheap price. Somehow or other, the daughter-in-law thought that she had brought it at one of these used clothing stores. And she was terribly offended, right? And yeah, reacted as you might think that she reacted. And the mother-in-law was terribly hurt. But then now here she's trying to do something nice. Here she gets such a patch for it, right? But if she could only know that what she thought, given what she thought, if it was true, right, she might have had some legitimate right for her reaction, right? But she was under mistaken thought. To be able to tolerate what another person does and not jump to conclusions. I think it's important to realize that it's not only a question of parents-in-law and children-in-law, it's also a question of sisters-in-law and brothers-in-law. Because a older brother may have had a kind of, if not control, may have a kind of hero worship that his younger brother worshipped him. Right? That's not uncommon at all. Right? Whatever the older brother says is fine, whatever he does is fine, right? And now comes this young woman who's going to take him away. Right? And he, just as the parents may feel that as a lot, the brother-in-law may feel it even as the older brother may even feel it as a greater loss. I think we have to be very, very careful about what we call triangulation. You know, 3 people relating. A does not relate to C only through B. Right? That's a triangle. I think that can get into all kinds of trouble. Young woman gets married to this youngest son of the family. Okay. This youngest son, there's a span of 9 years between him and his next older sibling. Right? And he was the baby of the family. Right? And as the baby of the family, maybe he was pampered, whatever. Right? And so they got married. Right? One of the other siblings said, now, you ought to realize that Yoni was pampered, right? And that because he was the youngest, he got his way with everything. Begin to compare kinds of things, right? What is he getting? Is he getting more than me? Is he getting more? These kinds of things can happen with brothers-in-law and sisters-in-law. And again, that can be reason for hard feelings if only things could be recognized and worked out. And here the parents can be very helpful in trying to help their children understand that, hey, Yoni is getting married and he's the child just like the rest of a child. Yes, maybe we had some favoritism because he was the baby and we pampered him, etc. But not to let it get into a kind of thing where people are going to think that there's going to be favoritism now and Yoni's going to get what the others did not get. I think that if we take all of these things into consideration and if we keep if we bring it down to just 2 simple concepts. One is the first one that I mentioned, and that is that in approaching marriage, the young man and the young woman and the parents on both sides should understand the awesome responsibility of what marriage means, and that is new children are going to be brought in the world, and they have to be given the best possible chance for happiness. And that any kind of squabbles between mechatonim, between parents and children, can affect a child at a very young age, because kids are sensitive. You know that children, when they are born, have the same 100 billion cells that we have now. I don't have that many anymore, but, you know. But they have the same 100 billion cells. But they are not filled with all the kind of stuff that we've put in there during the years. I mean, we carry around a lot of useless information that clutters up our brain. I mean, we remember telephone numbers and addresses and all kinds of foolish things that are no longer relevant, and yet we'll remember them. They're sitting up there in their brain. If they're sitting up their brain, they're taking up space. Well, with these kids, they don't have that. So they've got these hundreds, billion cells that are open and can pick up things, and they can pick up brain waves like that. They can pick up emotions. Don't think that the kids don't feel it. Kids feel it exquisitely. And if there's any kind of difficulty in the family, the kids will pick it up, and that's dangerous to the kids' health. So again, principle number one, remember, it's a pikuach nefesh. Children should be brought into the world with the maximum of a healthy environment of affection and cooperation between all members of the family. If we realize that that is a chayv kodesh, a sacred thing, I think that we can put everything else in perspective. The other thing is to realize that a person's actions don't necessarily mean that that is what he or she feels toward me. Right? He or she may be relating toward me on the basis of something that has nothing to do with me. She may come in and dislike me because I remind her of the fifth grade teacher, or something of the equivalent. And to remember that displacement and transference happen so often, and not to take anything as an affront or as an insult or as a hard feeling, or why isn't she close with me? Why is she distant from me? I think we can gain a lot from doing some reading on books about in-law relationships. Good ideas can come from them, and young people certainly should read up on books about marriage before they get married and early into the marriage, again, to try and clarify kinds of things. You can't read my book yet on in-laws because I'm just tearing it up, and it's going to take another good year before I rewrite it. I see I made some very significant mistakes there. So wonderful if we could use simple seichel. Right? You know what it's like if a young woman will call her mother-in-law and say whatever she wants to call her, right? Mom or shvigi or whatever. Could you tell me what foods Shimi likes? Or better yet, can you show me how to make them? Okay. I mean, that in itself can buy you Olam Haba with a mother-in-law. I know that Shimi always talks about how you make the meatloaf or how you make the chocolate cake or whatever. Can you show me how to do it? And by the same token, if the mother-in-law comes in and she says, honey, if there's anything you want to know, please don't hesitate. But not to say, I'm going to teach you how to cook. Because that can be taken. What does she think? She thinks, I don't know. Let me tell you a very personal thing. I haven't talked about this very often. My father was a doting father. If any of the kids as much had the sniffles, right, he was ready to send us to Mayo Clinic. That's the way he was. Anyway. So, I must have been married either 3 or 4 months, and I came down with a cold. Right? Several times a day, my father called to check up as to whether I was drinking enough tea and whether I was this and whether I was this and whether this. And my wife, what does he think? They're not going to take care of you? Right? But if she could have only understand this person's weakness, right? and how he dotes over his children, and that's his thing, okay? And it wasn't Chas V'Shalom meant as any kind of offense toward her. But these are the kinds of things that are innocent remarks that can, if we don't use our seichel, right, and we react immediately and without patience, without empathy, without tolerance, without consideration, that can give rise to hard feelings. Many, many things can be, difficulties can be avoided. Right? But if you keep the four buzzwords in mind, right? Empathy, to always try and think, why may the other person be reacting that way? Right? Given what he thinks, maybe he's justified. Patience, things don't have to happen quickly. Right? There is no microwave for relationships. Consideration, to be extremely sensitive to another person's feelings, to try to do everything possible to avoid that. And you know, sometimes that backfires. You can't help that, but sometimes it backfires. When I used to walk to shul in Pittsburgh, it was about four blocks from me to the shul. Two blocks later, closer to the shul, there was a man who had walked very slowly and walked with a cane. And I felt, you know, if I'm going to walk quickly, normally, and pass him by, then maybe I can feel bad. Right? So in my effort to be sensitive to his feelings, I would walk on the other side of the street. Right? So I shouldn't have to pass him by and cause him to feel bad. And then one day he said to me, why do you walk on the other side of the street and avoid me? What, do you think I'm going to hit you with my cane? Yeah. So it backfired, right? But look, I don't have control of how other people are going to feel. But you try to be sensitive. And when you're sensitive, I think things can be worked out. So it's empathy, consideration, patience, and tolerance, being able to accept without reacting. I think we have to be very cautious about being truthful, and that it is the greatest mitzvah in the world to be truthful. I don't think that there's a hetta for saying a lie, except in very, very unusual circumstances where, for Shalom Bayis, that you may have to say something which isn't true. But let me tell you that even though there's an issur in the Torah, lo yishaku, not to lie, midvashek el tilchok, keep your distance from lying, I might tell you that, like anybody else, I used to do my share of white lies, right? There's all kinds of a theorem as to why you can do this, why this, right? And then something happened that changed my attitude completely. What happened was that I was in my first year of psychiatric training, and I had a patient who was a kvetch, right? Complained about everything from head to toe. And my feeling was, look, he's kvetching, he wants attention, he wants medication. So I said to the nurse, give him an injection of salt water. That's called a placebo, right? You give him something which is nothing, but so he gets the little injection. The year before, when I was an intern in general medicine, we used to use placebos, right? And we used to give the person an injection and he'd feel better, even though we didn't give him anything. And so I told the nurse, give Harry a cc of saline. She says, we're not allowed to do that. I said, what do you mean we're not allowed to do that? She says, the medical director's orders are we're not allowed to use placebos. That doesn't make any sense. I used placebos last year. She says, that's the orders. So I was curious, so I went back down. I went down to the medical director, And I said, can you explain to me why you don't allow the use of placebos? So he says to me, Dr. Tversky, we have several ways of communicating. We communicate a great deal by nonverbal communication, right? By the way we look, by the way we talk, by the way, a lot of body language. He says that's real communication. And we also can communicate verbally. Now, you can control what you say verbally. You cannot control your body language. Now, if you're going to go to this patient and say, I am going to give you something, your body language is going to say, I'm giving you nothing. And you're giving him a double message. Right? And you think that he's only going to pick up what you say verbally? Not true. He's going to pick up your body language. He says, the only thing you've got going for you, the practice of psychiatry, is the trust that your patient can have in you. Right? You can't avoid to jeopardize that trust by giving a double message. That was in 1961. It may sound like a gaiva, but I don't think I've said a lie since then. And not because it's osa. I could have found the tatum. But because he made me realize I'm not a good liar. And I might tell all of you, none of you are good liars. You might think you can lie well, right? It is so much better if we can be truthful. Now, you have to be careful sometimes how you express a truth. But I think that by remaining truthful, you can avoid many of the kinds of distortions and many of the kinds of misinterpretations that happens when we lie. Getting late. At this point, I would just like to say, okay, look, I told you at the beginning, there's no way that we're going to be able to cover everything that has to be said, right? It would take perhaps hours and hours, if not days and days, to be able to give it fair coverage. But I mentioned some ideas that I'd like you to keep in mind, and I certainly would like everyone, younger or older, to realize I wasn't born an engineer. I wasn't born a psychiatrist, right? I wasn't born a lawyer. It takes training to become one. Right? I wasn't born an in-law. I wasn't born a son-in-law. I wasn't born a daughter-in-law. I wasn't born a father-in-law. I wasn't born a mother-in-law. It takes training to become one. Right? And especially when the first child gets married, this is a totally new experience. But then you think, okay, but now I'm marrying off my fourth child. I know it already. Circumstances are totally different with the fourth child than they were with the first three. Right? And again, we need a great deal of open-mindedness, patience, tolerance, consideration, and empathy. And if we have those, then Mezos Hashem, things can work out well, so that all mechatonim, in-laws, parents-in-law, children-in-law, can have a wonderful and happy relationship. And if any situation does come up which seems to be a problematic one, don't sit on it. Take it to someone to discuss it with. Somebody who's a badass, a knowledgeable person, whether it's a therapist or a rover or Rebbetzin who's had experience in relationships, and hear yourself talk. 99% of the time, when you discuss a problem and you verbalize it, you begin to realize the answer to yourself. And this is why they say that psychiatrists, all they do is listen. Right? It's not quite true. But even if all they would do is listen, right? It's very interesting. Moshe Rabbeinu said in Parshas Yisro, right? Well, no, it happened in Parshas Yisro, he didn't say it until the vote. But he set up the system of judges. Right? He said, you take care of things, and v'hadovra sheyikshem ikem, and anything that will be too difficult for you, takrivon elai, v'shamati, bring it to me, and I will listen. He didn't say, I'm going to tell you what to do. He said, I'm going to listen. And if it's good enough for Moshe Rabbeinu, it should be good enough for us. That if we find ourselves in any kind of, instead of jumping to conclusions, get to someone who will listen.
some reasonable, sensible person who will listen, who may be able to give you some guidelines, but more than anything else, he will listen. Okay, so those are the points that I wanted to share with you, and now we may have a few minutes for taking some questions and see if I can find some answers.
First of all, did somebody lose a cell phone? If you do, I have it. If you did, I have it here. I'll put it here. Thank you very much, Dr. Twersky, Rabbi Dr. Twersky.
Like microphone.
Oh, this one. Okay. See, you're very helpful. I'm not a good lawyer, so I want to say you can believe me that I really learned a lot from you tonight as a son-in-law, as a father-in-law. I really appreciate your remarks. Just to piggyback on some things that you said, I have a private practice also, and when you talked about logic, abandoning logic, you know, I often feel that in my own private practice I should put a sign up that says, "All ye who enter here, abandon logic."
Say what?
Abandon logic, because I find that very often people react on impressions and things that are quite illogical. And I think it's very true what you said about in-laws. And I know that very often when we, as parents, we want our children to marry and we want the best for them. But you're right, I think, that despite this wish, there's often a feeling of loss. And there sometimes is a feeling of anger at the spouse for taking our child away from us. And it's something that I think we have to work through. Also, you mentioned the idea of independence. And I remember that in growing up in my home, my father would always say to me, "Well, you can do what you want when you get into your own home, when you have your own family." And I remember how much respect I had for him when he stuck to that. And when, in fact, I got married, he always respected my home and my wife's opinion, and he always stayed away, and he kept his word. And it really was such a help in our own marriage. The third thing that you said that really interested me, and perhaps we could start the question and answer question period off with this, is you said that very often children are not prepared for marriage. It's something they look forward to. It's something that we look forward for them. And I'm wondering how you feel about, or how it is that children can become better prepared for marriage and for being children-in-law and the like. Perhaps you can comment on that.
Well, let me address the last question. Several years ago, I came across a book entitled Saving Your Marriage Before It Starts. And I was very impressed by it. It was written by a psychologist in Seattle. And I realized that in the Frum community, we are very sensitive about taking any kind of counseling or advice if it doesn't come from someone who has a Torah Hashkofet. And that as good as this book might be, it's not going to be picked up by many people who need it because, you know, he's a Gentile and he has no idea of what our standards are and how can he relate to that. So I called him up and I said, "Look, your book is excellent, but there is an entire community who is not going to be able to read it. I would like your permission to rewrite it." So he said, "Well, go ahead, just send me a copy." So I then wrote the book, The First Year of Marriage, using many of his ideas, bringing up the kinds of things, some of which we talked about, the kinds of things that people may have unrealistic expectations. I don't know how today is today, but I remember kids growing up with, and they lived happily ever after, right? And expecting that they're going to be able to have happily ever after. Right? And like none of the fairy tales talk about the problems that come up. So I think that one of the things to do is to read up. There are several books on preparation for marriage. There are also now several courses. Shalom Task Force has a course called the Shalom Workforce or something like this. There's a group called a course called Binyan Adayab, which is for young men, young women who, even before engagement, right, to try and help them with ideas about marriage. So I think that there are ways, both in reading and at least it opens up our minds. It opens up our minds to considerations that we might not have thought of before. So I think that there is that these are ways to that there can be a better preparation.
What can parents do?
I'm sorry?
What can parents do?
What can
parents?
Well, I think what good question. What can parents do? Perhaps the best thing that parents can do is to see that their kids get the courses. Right? There's some very interesting books that are written about the fact that whether we like it or not, children are going to bring the past history of the marriage they saw into their marriage. Even though they might say, no, I never would do that. Right? And we have a situation, for example, you know, it's well known that a child who was abused by his father, right, instead of when I grow up and I have children, I'll never be like that. And we know what's going to happen. The likelihood he's going to be as abusive as his father was. Doesn't make any sense, but that's what happens. And sometimes we may be critical of our parents' marriage. Didn't like the way they related. And I'll never do that. And then we get into a marriage and we repeat the same pattern. I think that the best thing that parents can do, again, is we've mentioned the four buzzwords, but also to encourage their children. You're a wonderful young man, you're a wonderful young woman, but you're going into a new kind of relationship that you've never been in before. You've never been in this relationship with anyone before. It's a totally new thing. You ought to read up on it, prepare yourself for it, and talk with somebody before. You know that if people would seek marriage counseling individually before they got married, they wouldn't have to do it afterwards. Okay? And it's so much better, medicine has conquered many diseases, not by treatment, but by prevention. Right? Immunization is the best treatment. Right? And if we could do preventative work, then I think that we would avoid problems afterwards. Any questions? We couldn't have covered it all that good in an hour. Well, again, thank you for sacrificing your Super Bowl to come here.
Thank you.
Be well. No.